So this morning now we come to the end of book one of Mark's Gospel. In the first part we looked at the healing and liberating word of God through Jesus. Then we just looked at the power of God expressed in parable and then in these three extraordinary pageants we've looked at. And now we're going to come to this. Only by a miracle of grace can we receive this word, this healing, liberating and powerful word. Jesus went about among the villages teaching. He calls the 12 and began to send them out, and the verb to send out is apostello, from which we get apostle, send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. He ordered them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, which recalls the staff of Moses journeying through the wilderness. No bread, because God's going to nourish them. No bag, no money. They're not going to be able to buy any of this. They are to wear sandals. This is Mark's rendition. The others are different. When we're reading Mark, sandals again takes us back to the book of Exodus, when they had sandals ready to journey. So they're on a mission journey. The first one mentioned here in Mark. He said to them, wherever you enter a house, stay there until you leave the place. If any place will not welcome you and they refuse to hear you, as you leave, shake off the dust that is on your feet as a testimony against them. A practice that the Jews at the time had when they came out of Gentile country from wherever, they would shake the dust off lest they bring it in and pollute the Holy Land. It's a symbol and it's fairly obvious. Well, if they're not welcomed, they are to shake the dust off their feet, keep moving till they are. So as they went, they proclaimed the message of John the Baptist, the message of Jesus, the message of the apostles. They are to repent, change their way of thinking, look at things differently. They cast out many demons, so their love penetrated to the broken psyche. And they anointed with oil many who were sick and cured them. King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. Some were saying, John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead, and for this reason these powers are at work in him. Very strange cultural way of thinking. It doesn't belong to us, but to imagine someone, Jesus is John the Baptist, come back to life is, I would find that pretty odd. I imagine you would too, but they didn't. They lived in that world. So some are saying John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead, and for this reason these powers work in him. Others saying it's Elijah. You know the story of Elijah? Extraordinary story. Elijah, we're never told about his death. He's the great prophet, and he was taken up in a fiery chariot. And that led to the folklore, you might call it. And they imagined that he was still alive with God somehow, and he would come back to the earth and introduce the Messiah. And this whole book is about Jesus is the Messiah. So if they thought he might be this Elijah. Others said, no, no, he's a prophet. He's like one of the prophets of old. When Herod heard of it, his conscience is playing on him. He said, it's John whom I beheaded. He's been raised. For Herod himself had sent men who arrested John, bound him and put him in prison on account of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because Herod had married her. There follows, and I won't read it for you, it's read it yourself if you wish, the story of the dancing of Salome and Herod's saying, I'll give you half my kingdom, and then she asked for the head of John the Baptist. It describes the death of this wonderful prophet. The apostles gather around Jesus and told him all they'd done and taught. Keep the scene clear. They're coming back from their first mission. He's with them, of course, but not physically. They've gone off in twos. They come back, I don't know, excited, despairing, down, amazed, whatever their feelings are, but they're telling Jesus all that happened on their first missionary journey. And something in what they said, Jesus realizes they've got something radical to learn, don't we all? So he said to them, come away to a deserted place, all by yourselves, and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. So they went away in a boat to a deserted place by themselves. And now Jesus is going to teach the missionaries, that's all of us, the key lesson they need to learn if their mission is going to be truly fruitful. But he won't put it in words, Mark. He'll ask us to look, and he describes a scene which says it in a way we can never forget. Words can be forgotten. Experiences such as this, can't forget them. Now, Mark continues, many saw them going and recognized them. And they hurried there on foot from all the towns, and they arrived ahead of them. As Jesus went ashore, he saw a large crowd. And of course, most of us could well have got in the boat and rowed back. Don't know, because they all need a rest, and they need, and Jesus got something important to share. But bigger than all that is his heart and his compassion. So he has compassion on them, for they're like sheep without a shepherd. That's actually a quotation from the book of Numbers about Moses. So the writers are constantly bringing in these threads to make sure we see Jesus as the new Moses, the new prophet. And what did Jesus do when he was moved with compassion for them? In Matthew, he heals. Good. In Mark, he teaches. Aware that a change of mind is critical to discipleship. And now we come to a scene you all know. And your question that you're asking yourself is, what is Mark telling us in this scene? When it was first proclaimed in the assembly, most people didn't read and write, so it's been proclaimed to them to hear. What were they thinking? What did they imagine? How did they read it? Well, here we go. It grew late, and his disciples came to Jesus and said, This is a deserted place. The hour is very late. Send them away. Very thoughtful of them. Send them away so they can go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves something to eat. You would think you can't fault that. Jesus takes them deeper, takes us deeper. And this is the key line in this scene. You give them something to eat yourselves. You do it. Jesus is not against referring, of course. He's not against us recognizing our limits and finding someone else who can help a person better. That's all common sense and obvious. But this is deeper than common sense here. Jesus is saying to us, to you, to me, okay, we're thinking they need food, let's send them away. And he says, no, wait a minute. You feed them. You do it. A wonderful woman whom she died, but when she was alive, I couldn't but admire her. This was the key to her life, in a way. She said that she lived in Randwick, and one of the MSC priests said to her one day as a young mother, if someone asks you to do something, they want you to do it. So as far as I'm able to tell, she lived off that for 70 years. She just did what she could. So what about us? You give them something to eat. Now come all the questions. And they said to him, look, how are we to go and buy 200 days' wages worth of bread and give it to them to eat? That's how much it'll cost. We haven't got the money. What are you talking about? How can we do that? So Jesus says, okay, how many loaves do you have? What have you got? Go, see. See what gifts you've got. See what you could give. And they found out, and they come back, and of course this will win the argument you'd expect. We've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. So we find out later there's 5,000 men, add the women and kids, and you've got quite a crowd. And they're not going to be fed by 5 loaves and 2 fish. Jesus ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. The scene recalls Moses in the desert, and for protection purposes, when they would camp in groups of hundreds and fifties. Protection. So we're back with Moses in the wilderness journey. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, this is Jesus doing this. Jesus looked up to heaven and blessed, meaning he praised God. So it's a prayer of praise. Then he broke the loaves, and our translation in the New Revised Standard Version says, and gave them to his disciples. But that's not what the Greek says. Each of those verbs, if you know a little bit French, is they're like this Greek, Latin, so you probably, maybe in your language too, they're all aorist up to here. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, an aorist parts. Well, aorist is used for something quite specific. He did this, he looked up to heaven, he blessed, he broke. The next verb is a different form of the verb, so you've got to translate it differently. It's something like he continued to give them. He was giving them. So it's a verb which tells you what's going on when things happen, not the next deliberate action. So I'll translate it for you. He continued to give them to his disciples. There's an important hint in that. I'll come back to this, but don't miss it, because no one missed it who first heard it. Look at Mark's account of the Last Supper. Taking a loaf of bread, blessing, he broke it and gave it to them. Same pattern. We're meant to think of the supper when we read this passage. I won't read the whole of the supper account, but just remind you that the language deliberately links this with the Eucharist. He gave it to his disciples to set before the people, and he divided the two fish among them all. And all, here's a quote from the psalm, all ate and were filled. Psalm 78:29. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. Those who'd eaten the loaves numbered 5,000 men. So, I'll try and unpack it for you, and you try to make sense of it, and I'll just offer the best I can. Is this a record of an event that happened in the desert one day? And if so, we might ask, why isn't it happening all the time? The image behind it, if it's an event, is of an intervening God. We talked about this earlier in the retreat. God who's out there, up there, somewhere, comes in to our ordinary nature and does something extraordinary against the laws of nature, often it's defined, and then leaves, and we're left with something that we can't explain by ordinary medicine or ordinary life. So it's a sign of the intervention of God. Well, and I don't put any weight on this, but it's true. You've obviously heard enough for me to know that's not my image of God. It might be yours, but it's not mine. It doesn't work out. So I'm suggesting that's not what we're reading. God doesn't intervene. God's present in everything, at the heart of everything. Marvellous things happen when in faith we're open to the presence. Marvellous things, including healing and anything else. But it's not intervening, it's presence that is welcomed and therefore has extraordinarily wonderful effects. So, is it a record? Or is it a dramatic portrayal of something that's happening all the time? All the time in our mission. Mission as a parent, mission as a public servant, mission as a engineer, mission as a whoever, social pastoral associate. Now, what's it doing? We know this much. The scene definitely recalls the legend of the manna, the story of the manna from heaven that nourished them all through those 40 years of journeying. Well, the literature that's talking, the Exodus happened in the 13th century. The documents are written in the 7th. So we've had a lot of oral tradition and storytelling and all that in the meantime. So when we come to the actual written account, It too is not event-centred. It's wonder of God's presence to these ancient ancestors as they journeyed to the Promised Land. So this scene certainly recalls the manna, doesn't it? Exodus 16. Jesus is being presented as the new Moses, feeding a multitude in the desert, the wilderness, the deserted place. When we do the Transfiguration, we'll see a scene, Jesus' prayer, and on each side is Moses and Elijah. And the scene ends, they saw no one but only Jesus. He is the fulfillment of the Torah of Moses and the prophets then of Elijah. That's what this thing's about too. Jesus is the fulfillment. He is the Messiah. He fulfills all the dreams of Moses and Elijah. So Jesus is the new Moses and is nourishing us. God is nourishing us through Jesus on our journey, on our mission, on our journey to the promised land. All the time. Is this happening in our world? Well, that's what came to my mind this morning as I was finally preparing this. Think of all the soup kitchens around the place. You're probably involved in them. God, every town's got them. Think of the United Nations Care for Refugees, that millions of people who would starve to death unless this United Nations, which grew out of Christian faith, a wonderful post, extraordinary post-Second World War period when Christian Democrats in Germany and France and other places purposely, from their Christian convictions, founded this, didn't want us to ever go back to that again. And they tried to form a Europe, which they did beautifully try to, and then people were hacking away at it. You've heard of Brexit, I presume. And there's a lot of stuff happening. The dream could easily be lost. Don't we mustn't let it. The more we're together and economically dependent on each other, not trade warring, but dependent on each other, more likelihood we will have of peace. In any case, there too is an amazing example of feeding the hungry all the time, all over the world. Jesus is inspiring it, and people are picking it up. And the Eucharist I've already mentioned. The literature requires us to think of the Eucharist. Jesus fulfills in his ministry the ministry of the prophets. Here's a couple of texts. Elijah, the story of Elijah and the woman of Zarephath. I won't read it. Take it as read, but I will quote this bit. Her household ate for many days, we're told, in this legendary material, but it's based on profound truths. The jar of meal was not emptied, and the jug of oil did not fail, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke through Elijah. And even more closely, his disciple Elisha. Second book of Kings, chapter 4, reads, a man came bringing food to the man of God, Elisha. 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of the grain in his sack. And Elisha said, give it to the people and let them eat. But his servant said, how can I set this before 100 people? We've got 5,000 on our stage, but the similarities are obvious. And he repeated, give it to the people, let them eat, for thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left. He set it before them, they ate and had some left according to the word of the Lord. So at least this much is obvious. We've got a scene before us, which picks up the themes of Moses in the desert with the manna, Elijah and Elisha feeding miraculously, and a Eucharist which nourishes us all for our mission. All of that is certainly contained in the literature we've been reading. I'll read you from Isaiah 55. Let's meditate on it for a moment. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread? Why do you labor for that which doesn't satisfy? Listen carefully to me. Eat what is good. Delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen and you live, I will make with you an everlasting covenant. The Last Supper, I'll make with you an eternal covenant. That's the covenant of love, of assurance that I will be with you, of presence, of miraculous fruit of mission, if we cling to him. Here's Isaiah 25, the Messianic banquet. I won't read it. Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 9. God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance. They ate all they wanted and there was stuff left. So that by always having enough of everything, you may share abundantly in every good work. So there's our scene. Make of it what you can. Chapter 6, verse 45. Immediately, again, as I mentioned earlier, 27 times he uses that word. Mark loves it because he shifts, it's movement, it's urgent, it's fast, it's moving. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. After saying farewell to them, 5,000, and you can't imagine Jesus not greeting each of them with his eyes and his hands and his smile and everything else. So there's a few hours in that. After saying farewell to them, what does Jesus do? We know this from earlier writings of Mark. He went up on the mountain to pray. Communion with God, the centre of all he is and all he does and all he says. So there's a scene. The boat on the lake. Chaos, always dangerous, always difficult, always problematic. And Jesus up on the mountain. By the time this is written and read, Jesus is in heaven, of course. He's not here. Well, he is here, but not the way we are. No, you don't look for them among the dead. He's risen, he's with the Father, he's in heaven. But wait. When evening came, the boat was out on the sea and he was alone on the land. It would appear he's not with them. When he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind, he comes towards them early in the morning. It's actually the fourth watch of the night. It's been a long night for them. Difficult, problematic. And now they've done from sunset to 9 o'clock, from 9 o'clock to 12, from 12 o'clock to 3 a.m. Not exactly, but that's how it was divided. And now in the fourth watch of the night, just as dawn is about to break, and dawn does break on stage, when the sun, Jesus, brings light into this chaos. There he was, he came to them walking on the sea. He intended to pass them by, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, take heart, have courage. It is I. Ego, ego, eimi. Ego, eimi. Ho'on is the Septuagint translation of Eye, Asher, Eye. God says, I will be who I will be. He doesn't give a name. When that's translated in from that dynamic, unabstract language of Hebrew, when it's translated into the abstract Greek world, it becomes I am the one, ego, Amy, Owen. So as soon as you hear anybody in the time hears ego, Amy, they can't but think of the burning bush and Moses and God saying, I will be with you. So God is, Paul, God is in Christ redeeming the world. Don't be afraid. Then Jesus got into the boat with them and the wind ceased. They were utterly astounded, for they didn't understand about the loaves. I remember being totally puzzled by that. I couldn't see the connection between walking on water and the loaves. Maybe you couldn't either, but I couldn't. And I remember when first worked it all out, I had some sickness which I think later was said to be encephalitis, which apparently can be lethal. Anyhow, I was crook for many weeks, month more, I think, at the university. So I'd get up in the morning, go to the uni, sit down, talk to students all day, same as come home, collapse into bed, and my light was very painful. So at the end, God, I'm not telling you all this anyhow, I'll finish it. At the end of whatever period it was, I just said to the provincial at the time, I said, look, I think I've just lost it. I mean, because I was in headachy and photophobic. And so he suggested I take a break. So I went up with my brother to Hagita in Papua New Guinea, where my brother was there looking after the students. And by the time I got there, I suppose that whatever the virus was I had, which had gone, done its job and I lived, obviously. So it kind of cleared. That's when I first finished writing that book, The Four Gospels, which was everywhere years ago. It's well and truly out of date now. And one of the things I remember seeing when I had that space, first time I feel a bit, right, what would I do? I write a book, oh, that's what I do. So I did this, and that's when I remember thinking, oh, that's what the connection is. Understanding the loaves is understanding God's presence, power, nourishment, presence mainly. So if they'd understood that, they would have known that even though Jesus has left them and he's been crucified and gone into the mystery of God, he is still with them. That's the connection. And they have to keep learning, as I have to keep learning, and you have to keep learning, that he is with us. But what's that scene saying? Once again, is it describing an event that only happened once? Doesn't happen again? In a way, what would be the point? Some think it proves that Jesus is divine, but that's the logic of that collapse as soon as you ever look at it. Does God walk on water? Well, wait a minute, let's read this. Thus says Yahweh, he who created you, O Jacob, and formed you, O Israel, don't be afraid. I've redeemed you. I've called you by your name. You're mine. When you pass through the waters, the chaos, I'll be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. That's Isaiah 43. Isaiah 53. Was it not you, says the prophet to God, who dried up the sea, the legend of the crossing of the Red Sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to cross through the waters. They crossed and got to the other side. That's part of this scene too. Exodus 25, Exodus 15. The Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. Psalm 77. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Chaos. The very deep trembled. The earth, they understood the earth was built on pillars, which were built, don't ask me how this works out, because I'm sure I didn't know either, on the depth on the sea, the ocean, which surrounded everything, the waters. So, the very deep trembled. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet your footprints were unseen. God doesn't walk. God doesn't have footprints, literally, for heaven's sake. So we're dealing with metaphor, of course. We're dealing with symbolic language. Chaos, which can drag us down, can't drag God down. God walks on the waters. God rises above it. God in Jesus wasn't sucked down into the chaos. And where do you see that most? On the cross. Job chapter 9, you stretched out the heavens, you trampled the waves of the sea. Mark is presenting Jesus to us the way he came to see him. We've already seen he's the fulfillment of Moses and Elijah. He's the Messiah. Well, here we're seeing him. He's the Messiah of God. God is in Christ and he will not be dragged. He's sinless. So he's not dragged into the chaos. He walks on water. Not literally for heaven's sake, but truly. So we continue our text. When they'd crossed over, they came to the land at Gennesaret and moored the boat. When they got out of the boat, people at once recognized Jesus and rushed about that whole region and began to bring in the sick on mats to wherever they heard he was. But wherever he went, into village or cities or farms, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged him that they might touch even the fringe of his cloak. And all who touched it were healed. When the Pharisees and some of the scribes who'd come from Jerusalem gather around Jesus, they notice that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands. That is, they didn't wash them. And Mark in Rome, because they're not all Jews, a lot of the Christians were, but some weren't, so he explains to them this custom. They mayn't be aware of it. The Pharisees and all the Jews, and by Jews he means those who never followed Jesus. That's same in John's Gospel. When the Jews are mentioned, it means that group of Jews who didn't convert and, in fact, opposed. So, the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they don't eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, like the washing of cups and pots and bronze kettles. Nothing wrong with any of that. It's their customs. So, the Pharisees and the scribes ask him, why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders? They're eating with unwashed hands. And Jesus said to them, Isaiah prophesied rightly about you, hypocrites. Hypocrites means an actor on stage. And the actors on stage in those days, as you probably know, wore a mask, not to hide anything, but to indicate to those observing, often from a distance in the theatre, who the actor was, Clytemnestra or Agamemnon or whoever. So that's it. And a persona, by the way, a person Persona means that through which the sound comes. So again, persona means mask, as long as you don't read that as a hiding mask, but rather a revealing one. So he calls them hypocrites. They're living on the surface. They're presenting, they're caught up on the surface of things, acting a part in a way. Of you, it's written, this people honours me with their lips. Their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines. You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition. You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your traditions. Jesus isn't saying there's anything wrong with the traditions. It's just that they have to have eyes to see when something, when love is required, you must love, whatever the tradition. That's what he did. And he got crucified for it. That's what the Christian church is asked to do too. For Moses, this is why he's calling them hypocrites. Moses said, honour your father and your mother. And whoever speaks evil of father or mother must surely die. But you say, if anyone tells father or mother, whatever support you might have from me is korban, I've defined it down the bottom there in black, you dedicate something to God as though it were placed in a temple sanctuary. You can later redeem it and sell it, but while it's there, it's sacred and you can't touch it. So here you've got the millionaire sons neglecting their dying parents, and they're saying, oh, we'd love to help you, I'm sorry, but we put all the money in the temple with God and it's sacred and we can't help you. Well, bully for them. You support you might have for me, that is an offering to God. Then you no longer permit doing anything for a father or mother, thus making void the word of God through your tradition. Getting the perspectives all wrong. That you have handed on, and you do many things like this. Hopefully, some of those hearing this were hurt to the heart and thought, he's right. And changed and became disciples, of course. We're not putting them all bad, but enough of them didn't accept it to get crucified, get Jesus crucified. He called the crowd again and said to them, listen to me, all of you. Understand, there's nothing outside a person that by going in can defile. It's the things that come out that defile. Heavens, that's a broad canvas. Just if I dare to, listen, we often criticize other people. We often criticize our circumstances for the way we are. Well, that's not entirely untrue often, but it's easy to blame someone else. The fact that you react this way to what's going on is something to do with you or me. So we better look at that. He made me angry. Well, I'm sorry, he can't make you angry. He can do things which trigger anger and you become angry because of something in you. Look at the way Jesus was treated. None of it was good, and we're not saying it's good. But it didn't stop him being Jesus. It didn't stop him loving. It didn't stop him praying. He didn't use that as an excuse for sin. He didn't sin. Well, here we are. It's only what comes out of us that can defile us. When he left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this. And he says to them, do you also fail to understand? Don't you get it? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile? It enters not the heart, but the stomach, and goes out into the sewer. And Mark says this, that Jesus made all things clean. The Jews couldn't eat this and couldn't eat that and couldn't eat that. Christians could eat anything because nothing was impure. And he said to them, it's what comes out of a person that defiles. For it's from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come. And in Mark names them. You could add and subtract from the list. Here they are: fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, the evil eye, slander, pride, folly. All these evil things come from within and they defile a person. So we need to work on our heart being pure. From there, Jesus set out and went away to the region of Tyre, that's in present Lebanon, north of Galilee. It's outside the Holy Land. He entered a house and he didn't want anyone to know he was there. You can all relate to that. He needed a break, presumably, it seems like it. Can't think of any other reason. Anyhow, he's there with his swimming costumes and his towel and he's going to just have a bit of a break. So he entered the house and didn't want anyone to know he was there, but he couldn't escape notice. A woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit, we're getting used to that. She's a very disturbed little girl for whatever reason, we don't know. Immediately heard about him, and like a good mother, she came and bowed down at his feet. The woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician. She was asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And Jesus said, and I'll have to do a bit of guessing here, but don't ever forget, Jesus didn't come to love. He came to give his Father's love. Jesus didn't come to mission, he came to follow his Father's will and do what God wanted. And up to this point, it seems, he discerned God's will was to minister in Galilee, Judea, in the area of the Jews. Small part of the world, but that was his mission. So God hasn't revealed anything else to him, so here he is, and he's not free to help her. So he said to her, let the children be fed first, the Jews. It's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the little dogs. We know how that went over, by the way, but it doesn't sound too good. Kynorion, little dogs, it's a diminutive. That was dogs was the word the Jews used of Gentiles. So Jesus is picking up the language of the time and wogs or whatever the word is in our culture. He says, no, that's not fair. But she's got a daughter who's sick. And all you mums know, you're not going to let him get away with this. So beautifully, she says, and just watch it, it's so clever. It gets Jesus roaring laughing, but it does more than that. It reveals to him that his mission isn't just to the Jews. She's clearly showing him something. And what she says is, even the little dogs, kynarion, under the table eat the little children's little crumbs. Paideion, the iron on the end is diminutive. So here she is, she's not going to let go. She picks up his image, she follows it through, and it's very hard to imagine Jesus not smiling and then realizing. He says, for saying that, okay, you win, go. The demon has left your daughter. So she went home, found the child lying on the bed, and the demon, the disturbed psyche is gone. She's in peace. And now Jesus' mission's in the Gentile territory. He heals a deaf man in the Gentile area. This is only in Mark, this scene. He returned from the region of Tyre and went by Sidon, still up there, toward the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis, the other side of the eastern side of the Jordan. And what do? They bring to him a deaf man who had an impediment in his speech, and they beg him to lay his hands on him. He took the man aside in private, away from the crowd, put his fingers in his ears, spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to the man, "Ephphatha, be open." And immediately his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus ordered him not to tell anyone. We've seen that often, and I know you understand it. But the more he ordered them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. They were astounded beyond measure, saying, "He's done everything well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." Isaiah chapter 32. The eyes of those who have, this is when the Messiah comes. The eyes of those who have sight will not be closed. The ears of those who have hearing will listen. The minds of the rash will have good judgment, and the tongues of stammerers will speak readily and distinctly. Isaiah 35, the eyes of the blind shall be opened. He's not excluding physical blindness, but that's not what it's about. It's an enlightenment. The eyes of the blind, the way we can be, shall be opened. The ears of the deaf, we can't hear. It's all around us, it's obvious, but we're not hearing it. Well, the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. The lame, don't know how to go, can't walk, can't. No, they'll leap like a deer. And the tongue of the speechless will sing for joy. We've got nothing to say, and then we've got everything to say. The mission of Jesus. Ezekiel 24. On that day, the day of promise, the day Mark is showing us is here. On that day your mouth shall be opened and you shall speak and no longer be silent. You shall be a sign to them, and they'll know that I am. Then comes the scene, we've heard it before. It's a retelling by Mark of the loaves and fishes story, but this time it's in Gentile territory. So the multiplication of the loaves isn't just for Jews, it's for Gentiles. And the early church picked on as much as they could of this to show that Jesus' mission was to the whole world, which of course Mark with Peter and Paul, that's what they're on about, taking it to the ends of the earth. So I'll take that as read. It's basically the same scene. Instead of 12, which is a very biblical term, 12 sons of Jacob, 12 tribes, 12 apostles, we're now not into the biblical, but 7, the perfection, fullness. But otherwise, it's basically the same story. Mark chapter 8, verse 10. Now there were about 4,000 people. He sent them away and got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. The Pharisees came and began to argue with Jesus, asking him for a sign from heaven to test him. Jesus sighed deeply in his spirit. Why does this generation ask for a sign? brackets. The only sign they're going to get is love. And there's plenty of that to see. That's what reveals God. So he sighs deeply and he says, I tell you, no sign will be given. He's not going to do something magic to convince them. They've got to watch, listen and convert. He left them. And getting into the boat, he went across to the other side. Now, they're in the boat. The disciples had forgotten to bring any loaves. They had only one loaf with them in the boat. And I think we're to imagine that loaf is actually Jesus. Anyhow, we'll come back to that. Jesus was cautioning them, saying, watch out, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod. It should leaven the loaf, but it's not. It's poisoning the food. Beware of it. And they take this all very literally. They were saying to another, wow, it's because we haven't brought any bread with this, he's picking on us. So they became aware of it, and Jesus says to them, what are you doing talking about having no bread? Do you still don't perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes and don't see? Do you have ears and don't hear? Or have you forgotten? Do you don't remember? Is that your problem? Remember right back when they said, we can't feed the people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Yes, you can. You can feed with what you've got. God will multiply it. Anyhow, back to this, Jesus' words. Jesus went on with it. Oh. Don't know what happened then, excuse me. I've missed some out, so I'll have to remind you of it. He goes on and says, where were you when we multiplied the loaves, the 5 loaves and the 2 fish? Have you forgotten that? And where were you when we multiplied the loaves in the Gentile area? So that's what they're failing to remember. We're failing to remember. We're failing to get the essence of what mission is about. And the scene ends this book one. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. He's as far away as you can get from the city of Jerusalem. On the way, he was asking his disciples, who do people say I am? We know already that the leaders want to destroy him. We know his family are out to take him home and restrain him. We know that he couldn't work miracles in Nazareth. We know that disciples don't get it. So that's all happened up to now. And here's Jesus saying to them, who do people say I am? They answered him, John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. He was asking them this, but who do you say I am? And we'll finish here because that's a good question to take into the afternoon. Who do you, who is Jesus for you? Who do you say I am? And Peter says, bringing the whole of the drama of book one to a conclusion, you are the Messiah. And Jesus sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about it. In other words, he wants them to learn.